Good morning. How's everyone doing? All right. It's been a good show for everyone. I can say for myself, it's been a really, really great show. I love seeing the enthusiasm from everyone. My name is Taylor Brown. I'm the lead program manager for all of our server container technologies. Translated, that means Windows Server containers and Hyper-V containers.
Mike Coleman, I'm a technology evangelist at Docker.
All right. So why are we here today? Well, hopefully, the clicker will work. We think containers are cool. We heard about them in keynotes. We heard about them throughout the week. We've been reading stuff about them for a while. Many of you I recognize caught the earlier session on kind of the what, why, and how of containers. Today we're going to talk, or this morning, about do a Docker overview. That's this session. And then a little later this afternoon, we'll take a step on how do we get started with containers. And we'll hear from Tycho to kind of kick that session off on how they actually moved their app into containers, and then some tangible steps on how to do that. And then Friday morning, there's a session from the Visual Studio team, and they're going to talk about some of the tools that they're building in Visual Studio to help make containerizing an application easier. Right. So great kind of session arc here. The real goal out of all of this is that when you leave Atlanta, you can go back home and get your first app in a container, right? If we can get to that point, then I feel like we've been successful, and ultimately that's going to lead you to being successful as well. So, you know, we've talked a lot about how the cloud, you know, the cloud does this, the cloud does that. You know, I think one of the important things is it's really changed the expectations that we all have about applications, right? If our applications aren't available, it's just not acceptable anymore, right? Like, if I go to a website, I expect it to work 100% of the time. It's like no downtime is ever really acceptable anymore. You know, you try to go watch a movie from Netflix. If it doesn't work, it's like what the hell? What's going on? Why is this not working? Right? You know, you look back a couple years and it's like, oh, you know, something was down for a few minutes, it was no big deal. You try back again, maybe, you know, go to sleep, try in the morning. Now it's just, we expect everything to be up all the time. And we go to work, we expect everything to be up there too. It's like, no, we can't have the, you know, payroll site down for, you know, maintenance window, even at, you know, midnight. People are like, well, you know, what if I wanted to look at my pay stub tonight? They just expect everything to be up all the time, right? We expect everything to be able to scale. You know, like come out with a new product announcement and we expect that website to be able to handle however much traffic it gets. And at the same time, we expect to only pay for the traffic we're using. So having extra capacity just kind of laying around because we are worried about the potential spike, well, you know, there's some CTO and sitting in the room going, no, like we're not gonna pay for that anymore, right? We can't afford to just have extra stuff sitting around. We've got to be able to scale on demand up and down. And then lastly, agility has become really, really important. If we miss the opportunity to capitalize on an investment that presented itself today, we may not get a chance to capitalize on it tomorrow, right? Everything is in this world of opportunity, capitalize on it, and move on to the next opportunity, right? The cloud really has driven these kind of changes into our business. And so with that kind of frame in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Mike and talk a little bit more about how Docker is helping us with these initiatives.
All right, Taylor, thanks. So who am I? Let's start real briefly about who I am and how I got here and kind of the perspective I bring to this problem. I am a technology evangelist at Docker, which means I write white papers, I build reference architectures, and I do a lot of speaking at conferences about Docker. But the difference is most people associate Docker, or at least they did in the early days, with sort of developers, right? But I'm actually an IT operations person. I was a Microsoft certified systems engineer on Windows NT 3.1, so that's how long ago that was. But even better than that, I was a certified Banyan engineer. I love that. People always, you know, like, there was like eight of us like, yeah, well, we thought it was better than Novell NDS, but I guess we were wrong. Anyway, so I did that, and I worked for some Fortune 100 companies as an architect and sysadmin. And then I moved into product management and product marketing. I spent time sort of in reverse order. At Microsoft for 6 years, I was an IT pro product manager for Windows. So I shipped Windows 2000, Windows XP. So if you've ever loaded Windows XP and you read the text that said Windows XP will make your life better and wash your car, I actually wrote that text. That's my second claim to fame at Microsoft. I have another claim to fame that you will only see if things go wrong. And then I went to VMware, so I spent 6 years in virtualization, right? So I come from this virtualization mindset. Then I went to Puppet Labs, where I got into open source and config management, and that brought me to Docker. And Docker is interesting for me because it sort of takes all of those three areas of my background and brings them together. I'm definitely more IT pro than developer, and you can follow me on Twitter, but mostly I tweet about Portland Timbers. Does anybody know what Portland Timbers is? In the back. Ray knows because Ray's from Portland with me. We're a soccer team. We're the reigning champions, actually, for like another 3 weeks, and then we'll be out of the playoffs. So this is what we're going to talk about today. Containers are not VMs. We're going to talk about the build, ship, run workflow. So how do you actually take an application from an idea into a production deployment, although it's not much of a production deployment. We'll talk about how containers are built, what they look like under the covers, why you should even care, wrap up with a real quick hitter on how you can get started. So as Taylor said, the goal is to get out of here, get back to your office, and be able to get up and running with Docker in a matter of minutes. So containers are not VMs. This is a super easy connection to make. When I came to Docker, and coming from VMware, someone explained to me the concept of a container, and I said, oh, that's just like a lightweight VM. And if you read a lot of press, or if you talk to a lot of people, they'll be, oh, it's a lightweight VM. Absolutely not a lightweight VM. It's an easy connection to make, because both offer isolation and both do a lot of similar functionality, but they do it in a very, very different way, and they do it with very, very different benefits, right? I hear a lot of people, oh, you're gonna destroy the virtual machine. It's like, no, we're not. Like, that's not the goal at all, at least not from my perspective. So let's talk about the differences. Virtual machines are houses. Right? So I use this analogy for people who come from a virtualization background or are familiar with VMs to kind of set a framework. A house is fully self-contained. It has its own heating, its own plumbing, its own air conditioning. Right? It's got a front door that locks, so it's got some security, some isolation. Right? But if I need another house, I build a full house, right? And I build my own heating, plumbing, and air conditioning. Like a virtual machine, it's a full copy of the operating system. It has a dedicated virtual CPU, a dedicated kernel for the workloads running in that VM. The other thing about houses is they only get so small, right? Houses, like my first house was 2-bedroom, 1-bath, a living area, living room, and a kitchen / dining room. It was 800 square feet. I paid $33,000 for it. Again, that's how long ago I bought a house. So if you contrast that to containers, they're apartments in an apartment building. An apartment building has shared infrastructure. All the apartments share heating, cooling, air conditioning. An apartment has a doorman that helps you figure out where somebody might live or take delivery of a package and sort of facilitate the orchestration of those apartments, right? Containers sit inside of the apartment building. Now, the apartment building I would refer to as the Docker host. A Docker host is any server, physical or virtual, cloud or data center, that runs the Docker engine. The Docker engine is the doorman. All the Docker engine does is start and stop containers and list out containers and help you build containers. It doesn't sit in the middle of the work you're trying to do and the underlying CPU, right? So the instruction doesn't go through a hypervisor. All a container is a process or service running on that server that's been isolated. So like an apartment, it's isolated. It has a front door. Right? You can't just walk into somebody's apartment. So you got full isolation in there, and you're sharing the kernel. So every container running on a given host shares that underlying kernel. There's a couple of really key benefits of that, and there's some things to be aware of. One of the benefits is instantiation time, because we're not booting up a full operating system, right? So a VM takes anywhere from 3 minutes to 20 minutes, maybe depending on what it's doing to boot up. So a container can boot up in a couple of seconds, right? I've actually seen them boot up in about 3/8 of a second, because we're not booting an operating system. We're just saying, start this process. And we'll see more of that as we get through here. But to be aware, because they share a kernel, you can't mix workloads. So on any given Docker host, it's either a Linux Docker host or it's a Windows Docker host. And that's, so people say, well, so I can't run my Windows workloads on Linux? No, if you want to do that, that's virtualization, right? If you want to be able to share on one hardware platform or one mixed OS workloads, that's virtualization. That's what that's there for. There's a lot of other reasons too. So shared resources, shared kernel, fast instantiation times, a little bit lighter weight. Depending on what you're doing, you can get container sizes down into a couple megabytes. And we've got customers that have got containers that are gigabytes in size, right? So there's a full range there that you can go through. But just because they're different doesn't mean they're mutually exclusive. So this comes from, I'll talk with customers and they'll say, Mike, where should I run my workload? Should I run it in a VM or should I run it on physical? Should I run it in cloud or should I run it in a data center? And I have one of two answers depending on how I'm feeling. At this point in the morning, I would probably just say I don't care, right? What I really mean is it doesn't matter. And you'll hear me say that a lot when you talk to me, if you've ever had a conversation with me about containers, because it doesn't matter. The choice is up to you. So let's talk about the two different models. So on your left, my right, I always have to look at it, is sort of a physical server, right? The Docker engine is sitting there. You've got some sort of underlying operating system, Windows Server 2016 or some version of Linux. So for Linux, it can be any version of Linux with a modern kernel, 3.1 or later, right? And you've got those containers running directly. I don't love this diagram. I should probably redo it because the engine doesn't sit between the physical hardware and those containers. The engine actually sits off to the side and just like I said, facilitates starting, stopping, listing, you know, looking at logs, those sort of things. Again, it's just more like that doorman. It's not a gatekeeper, so to speak. So on the other side of the screen, on the right side, my left, you can see a hypervisor with sort of mixed workload. So I've got a Windows Server 2016 VM, it's got the Docker engine in there, and it's running a couple of applications, right? And then next to it, I could have a Linux operating system, and it's got the Docker engine, and it's running some applications. So why would you do this? Like, why would you make a decision one way or the other? Well, there's a couple of reasons, right? The first one is, like, if you talk about physical server, that usually comes down to performance, right? Hypervisors introduce a degree of latency. It can be very small, or it could be a little, I wouldn't say huge, but there's latency there. And depending on your application and what you're trying to do, that might be enough to push you into a physical server configuration. There's a white paper from HPE. If you just Google HPE containers VMs performance, where they've basically, and they tested KVM and Docker, so it's not vSphere or Hyper-V, and they kind of ran through 5 or 6 different benchmarks, so they've got a lot of comparisons of that performance of running containers natively versus running the workload in a container natively versus a virtual machine, and you can kind of see how that sort of works itself out. The other one is sometimes that there's licensing cost advantages. If you have to pay a licensing cost for your hypervisor, some people will look at a bare metal solution. But there's a lot of reasons to stay in a VM, right? Virtual machines offer some really nice features around high availability, site recovery, live migration. Those sort of functionalities are not built into the Docker platform today. Right. We have some high availability, but the reality is the stuff that you get on most modern virtualization platforms is greater. The other one is, like you see on the screen, is the mixed workload, right? That physical server is only going to be Linux, and it's only going to be Windows, which really brings you to the other big issue. What was the very first use case for virtualization? Why did we do it? Anybody? Capacity, I heard it.
Consolidation.
Yeah. It was capacity consolidation. It was like 20%, 20%, 20%. We're gonna take all of those, we're gonna put them over there, and now we're running at 60 or 70%. And we've been able to use modern hardware and consolidate, reduce our data center footprint, bring down energy costs, all kinds of stuff. If you don't have enough horsepower, enough capacity to drive the full utilization of a physical server, then why waste the money, right? Put it in a VM and consolidate those workloads and mix them up. So the cool thing is, though, we haven't really talked about this, is that because of what containers bring you, and that is basically what I will call ultimate portability, and I don't like to be hyperbolic, but really they are ultimately portable. You can move a workload from a physical server, unmodified, and put it in a VM. You can move it from the cloud into the data center or back again. Once a container, because I didn't really talk about what a container has in it. So the container actually has everything your application needs to run. It has your OS definition. It has your libraries, your binaries. If it's an interpreted language, it has the interpreter in there. If it's a compiled language, it has the has the executable code. All that stuff is right there. It's in that container, isolated away. So I can move that, right? If I have a Docker engine, I can run that container. So I'm sitting there and it's on a physical server and I decide I want to move it into a VM, no problem. It's in the data center, I want to move it in the cloud, no problem. Vice versa, no problem. So that's sort of, if you come out of here with the relationship between VMs and containers and what you take away is that the choice is yours, then that's the point of the slide.
And I mean, the other part that I'll mention is for a lot of us, we're running in the cloud anyway. So we're running in hopefully Azure, often AWS, GCU, whatever that is. Well, if you're in that environment, you're in a VM, right? That's just, that is what it is, and that's fine. In fact, when we look at where containers are running, it's like 90% plus are, from the data that we can look at, are running inside of a VM. Why? Because they're running in the cloud.
Yep. Well, and most data centers are virtualized today anyway to a very high degree. So let's talk about what we announced this week, right? So our background is Linux, and I'll talk quite a bit about Linux containers. We'll talk about Azure and a bunch of stuff, but let's go back to Windows Server containers today. So for the last 2 years, matter of fact, I joined Docker in July of last year, so about 15 months ago. I started on Docker on a Monday, and on Thursday, I was in Redmond sitting in a meeting with Microsoft. So as long as I've been here, we've been working very closely with Microsoft and Taylor and our engineering teams to make sure that we could run containers the right way on Windows Server 2016. So the kernel has been engineered to handle the abstractions of a container, right? How do you isolate that? How do you use the user namespaces, and how do you do process isolation and all of these things? And like I said, that's been going on almost as long as Docker has been a company focused on containers, right? We've been a company focused on containers for a little over 3 years, and for a little over 2 years, we've been working with Redmond, literally on a daily basis to get this stuff up and running. Microsoft has become a huge contributor in open source. They are actually a Docker maintainer, and we didn't just make them a maintainer, right? Becoming a Docker maintainer is a process of high quality commits, sustained effort, being there every day, resolving issues, bringing stuff to the community, right? And that's really important to open source in general. It's very important to Docker, that if you are a member of the open source community in Docker and you want to be a maintainer, you're active and you're contributing, regularly, daily, as it were. And that's where Microsoft ended up. So what you have now is the exact same API and CLI interaction on Windows and Linux. Now, of course, you also have, for Windows containers, the ability to use PowerShell. So if you're a big PowerShell person.
And Linux, too.
Yeah, and Linux. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's a different world, yeah.
We're all cross-contaminated now. Yeah. So it's cool. So if you build a workflow for containers, that workflow translates between Windows and Linux. And it's pretty neat that way. The other thing that's unique to Windows that I like is the idea of a Hyper-V container. So I showed you that other slide where it was sort of like a container just running on the engine, right? And I showed you one where it was like a full-blown VM. So Hyper-V containers are sort of like between the two of those. It's a single container running in a Hyper-V shell, but it's not really a full Hyper-V VM. It's a stripped-down Hyper-V VM that is designed to give you that extra layer of isolation. There is a lot, there are companies out there that have sort of policies that say, look, I am not going to share a kernel, right? There are certain sensitive operations, there are certain sensitive data that regardless of what you tell me, I am not going to share that kernel. Yeah.
there's laws, PCI compliance. Like this, thou shalt have a hardware line. Okay, fine. Like here, check.
Yeah, and so that's where you get Hyper-V container. So you just say, look, it's easy, boom, it's a Hyper-V container, have a nice day. And then you've got that isolation that you need to remain in compliance with your business directives and in fact, yeah, legal compliance as well. And that's unique to the Windows Server 2016 platform. And it's actually kind of a pretty cool feature. So at the end of the day, what you end up with is this, what we call a build, ship, run workflow. And now, with this announcement with Windows Server 2016, you really can cover almost the entirety of your data center. Yes, that one, you know, you may have AIX or something in there, but who does that? Anyway,
there's
sorry.
There's some guy around here who's like, oh,
there's an IBM guy out there, what are you talking about? So we've got, you know, we say any app, and what we mean, like, so how many of you are ThinApp or AppV or ThinApp or Remote App or, not you guys, not those apps. I say that because I do have a lot of people come in. My background at VMware was actually end user computing. So I worked on VDI and I worked on ThinApp and that's, you know, what I spent a lot of time doing in virtualization. And while it sounds similar, one of the limitations, I guess not really limitations, it's just the architecture of Windows containers, is they don't present the Windows UI, right? You don't get that. And Linux, you have to like expose the X socket and it's fairly complex. It's not something you want to do on the regular. So we say any app, we mean data center applications, server-based applications, databases, business logic, web apps, right? And it doesn't matter what language you write in. Right? It could be ASP.NET. It could be ASP.NET on Linux. It could be .NET. It could be whatever you want it to be, Java. This is really powerful. And I'll spend a little bit of time talking about this now, because this is really powerful. How many of you are developers in the audience? Awesome. How many of you feel like you spend too much time maintaining your development environment and keeping it up to snuff so you can write software? Yeah, I did PyCon earlier this year because it was in Portland, not because I know anything about Python, because I don't. I mean, I do a little bit, but, and I had a couple of people come to me and say they spend like 50% of their time maintaining their development environment so they can run. And what if you're a Python developer and your buddy is a Java developer and he wants you to look at his code? Then are you going to set up a Java environment on your machine to do that? Are you going to spin up a VM? How are you going to do that, right? With Docker, the development environment is the container. Right? You define a container and you say, this is my Java container. This is my Python container. Your machine, your Windows laptop, your MacBook, your Linux machine, your whatever it is just the operating system and the Docker engine. That's all it takes. So if Taylor's a Java developer and he sends me his code, I just say Docker run Taylor's app. I never installed Java. I never installed his dependencies. I don't have .NET 3.5, .NET 4, type of stuff floating around. I just have everything I need. And I never ever have to think about how I run somebody's app. I just say Docker run that app. I don't have installation instructions. You know, I mean, you got some stuff you got to specify, but it's vastly simplified. So if you think about what that means as you go through this build, ship, run workflow, the next problem we have, and where Docker really started, if virtualization started with consolidation capacity, Docker started with, it doesn't work on my machine. So I'm a developer. How many of you have ever written an app and it worked great on your development environment, it went through QA and it didn't work in production? Anybody ever happen to you? It only happens about hourly. And that is fundamentally like somewhere, some library, some config file, some environment variable, some registry setting, some small thing that takes you 3 days to figure out broke the build, ship, run workflow. With Docker, you don't have to say, okay, make sure all these environments are, you know, did I install, is it the right version of IIS? Is it the right version of .NET? Did I have the right patching? Do I have all that? You have Windows Server 2016, and you have the Docker engine. And when that comes off the developer workstation, that artifact is immutable, it does not change, and it runs through your QA cycle, and then it goes into production. And with Docker, some things you can do, you can digitally sign the image, so you know exactly who it's coming from, and you know exactly what steps it's gone through. So when you put it in production, you know you're putting in production exactly the code that the developer intended, and all you have to worry about is, do I have the Docker engine running on that machine? Now, I came from Puppet, right? and Puppet and Chef and all those guys make great software. And this is to me, I look at this as another way of sort of solving that problem. Rather than making sure that all the right components are installed on the server, we just say, make sure you have the application written the way you want it to, and make sure the servers have a common baseline, and that's the Docker engine.
Yeah, and I think another really valuable point on that, you look at this container image, and unlike a VHD where it's like, okay, fine, I can crack it open, and there's some stuff in there, but it's impossible for me to figure out, like, how did that go from the ISO or the original VHD to the state it's in now? Right, I can't diff it. I can't really figure it out. A container image, we can actually go look at the lineage of it. What commands were run? What was done inside of that? I can reproduce that again in the exact same way. So when a dev gives me something, and I've got to figure out, like, what do they do with it? Oh, like, no, you can't install that piece of software in our production image. We don't have a license for it, right? I can actually go look at that and look at that lineage and say, ah, okay, I know what they did. And we can have a conversation about it as opposed to the interrogation, right? You go into their office with a light and like, what did you do? What was that VHD? How did you make it? Where did it come from? You know, like it just changes that conversation around completely.
Yeah, I talk about that to a lot of folks in the booth this week, was this idea of like, how many of you have those great run books that you've written up with every single detail? How many of you have ever run one extra command when you built the server that maybe you didn't document, right? I mean, you're going to rebuild it. If you lose the golden image, how do you get back? So we have something called a Docker file, right? And Docker files can be versioned along with your code. And between the Docker file and the container, you know exactly what happened. You can go, for developers out there, you can go from a Git push and trace everything back to the container and know exactly what changed. It's ultimately reproducible. And then, as we talked about before, with Windows support now, we cover the other 60% of the data center that we didn't have before, 60 to 65%, whatever that latest statistic is, depending on who you talk to. And we do that across a myriad of platforms. So I've done two trade shows this year where two companies have stood on stage and said, we were in the cloud and we wanted to move back to the data center. You know, for whatever reason, they moved a portion of their business back to the data center. One company took about 2 years to do that, 2 to 3 years to do that. They weren't on container technology. Another company had containerized their application and they did it in a month because they just had to roll it back. And it was probably a month to rack the servers and get them all installed and configured, and then they could move the containers over. To Taylor's example that he was talking about, one of my favorite questions to people is, you know, I'll walk up to you and I'll say, hey, how many VMs do you have? And you go, I have 1,000 VMs. And I say, well, I'm your new CIO and I love the cloud. I want you to take those 1,000, and I'm going to do vSphere VMs because it's a better example, because there's good portability between actually Windows Server and Azure. But so we'll say, take those 1,000 vSphere VMs and move them into Azure this weekend. And you say, the job market is hot right now. Don't bother me. I'm logging into Dice. Because that's a really hard problem to solve, right? And one of the coolest things about Docker for me is I have never gotten a complex system architecture 100% right the first time. I just haven't. Maybe you have. But when you make that decision and you realize you have to recover from it, containers make that super easy. Oh, I put it on physical. It should have been in virtual. I put it on the cloud. I should have had it in the data center. Put it in the data center. I want to put it in the cloud. I don't care. It doesn't matter. You can recover from those decisions very easily. I shouldn't say recover. You can modify your decision very easily. So from the developer's workstation to operations, the same artifacts, super easy. So build, ship, and run. So some vocabulary. We've talked a little bit about this, but let's level set a little bit. Docker image. An image is the basis for a container, right? So a Docker image is a set of layers, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next section, that comprise an application. And you start with an image by specifying an OS definition. So in Linux, I might say from Alpine, add Python, install all my requirements for my software, copy over my source code, expose a port, and when it starts up, run my application in Python. For Windows, it might be from Windows Server Core, use this PowerShell command to install Node, use this PowerShell command to install IIS, copy in my application code, expose a port, and when it starts up, run this Node app, start IIS, whatever it is. It's everything, right? So if you have an IIS application, it is the IIS binaries, and it is the ASP.NET code that you use to run your website, and it's anything else you need in there, right? It's everything you need. There's literally nothing needs to be on that server besides the Docker engine. So the image is basically this read-only artifact that a developer produces that represents the application. When you instantiate an image, you do that via the Docker run command, you get a container, right? And that's all that is to it. So that's an application that is running. So from an image, you get a container. We've talked a lot about the Docker engine, creates and ships and runs Docker containers. You can deploy it physical, virtual, all that stuff. And then one thing we haven't talked about is a registry service. A registry service is a special server on which Docker images live, right? You just throw them up there, right? We have a free one out on the internet called Docker Hub. You can go to hub.docker.com, create a free account, and you can store your images up there. If you want to pay us a little bit of money, you can have private repositories where it's locked down. It's just like, think of it like GitHub for images, right? Then we have one that you can run inside your corporate domain, in your VPC, in your private cloud, in your data center, whatever it is, and that's Docker Trusted Registry. Docker Trusted Registry is a commercial product. Everything else I've talked to up to this point is either open source or free. Trusted Registry is part of a product called Docker Data Center, and that's how we make money. People go, how do you make money? We make money with Docker Data Center support, a bunch of other things. So with those things in mind, some basic Docker commands. So you're going to see me run a demo, and you're going to see me type most of these commands. Docker pull nginx. Get me the nginx image from the Docker Hub. Go out to Docker Hub, put the nginx image on my local environment. Docker images. Show me all the images I've got on my machine. Docker run. Start a container. This one, it says Docker run dash D. Run my container in the background in detached mode. My container runs on port 5000, and I want it to communicate to the outside world through port 5000 on the Docker host. That's what p5000 5000 does. Give the container a name, catweb. This one is on Docker Hub, but it's in my repository. So my repository on Docker Hub is Mike G. Coleman, right? And I'm saying, give me the latest version. The colon after catweb is the version. So you can version all of your containers. Docker PS shows me all the running containers. Docker stop catweb, stop the container. Docker RM catweb, remove the container. Docker RMI, remove the image, right? And then Docker build is a command to take a Docker file, which I'm going to show you what a Docker file is, and create a new image. So a new image is created through a Docker file. There is another way to do it. I'm not even going to talk about it because you should never do it. If you find it, good for you.
Then forget about it. Like, don't tell your friends.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of building a virtual machine and not ever writing down anything you ever did and having no way to ever reproduce it reliably. So don't do it.
Don't go to production with that.
This is a cautionary tale. Yeah. So Docker build basically builds a new image, right? And Docker push takes your new image and moves it onto your registry, right? We're going to go through all of these commands in a demo so you can see them in action, but I wanted you to kind of have a chance for me to explain what they do before I actually go and do the demo.
And Mike said one thing that's kind of important that I just want to touch on. Yeah, just one. Out of that whole slide, it was just one. When he said, you know, dash, colon, latest, and it's versioned. That's a really, really important element of this. Because I can say, all right, I'm running on version 1.0 of the image, right? Everything's working great, whatever. You know, someone wants to tweak some logo or, you know, whatever it is, right? So they give me version 1.1. And I try to run it in production, and for whatever reason, like, things don't go well. Like, something else changed, whatever it is. Flipping back to version 1 is just as simple as saying, nope, move the pointer back. Make latest 1.0, and we're back to the way we were yesterday. We're back to the way we were right before I pushed that new version up, right? I can just go back in time. Now, when someone gives me the fix for it and it's 1.2, I can go, all right, great, like Docker run version 1.2. Hey, they fixed it. Now we move forward with our life, right? It's that easy to kind of move back and forward with versions.
Yeah, and we have functionality in Docker and something called swarm mode that even you just deploy a service and you say Docker service upgrade, it'll push that new version out for you. It'll roll it out slowly. You can back it out if there's a problem, right? So it's sort of like a blue-green upgrade, if you're familiar with that term. So how do we get an image? Dockerfiles. So we both have sort of mentioned Dockerfiles and what they are. This is where it starts. This is the fundamental building block for your image. And I have a Linux example, and then I have a Windows example. Anybody in the room a Python developer? Do you inherently know what that's doing when you read it? Yeah. Because those commands that you see up there are the exact same commands you would issue from the command line to get a Python application up and running. The very first one says from Alpine latest. That just says use Alpine Linux as the base definition. I didn't really talk about this, but I can have my Docker engine running on Red Hat or Ubuntu or CentOS or Slack or whatever, but I can make my running container thinks it's running on something else. So in my case, I could deploy, and so you don't have to match distros. Right? The distros can be completely different. So in this case, I'm saying, I don't care what you think you're running on, what you're running on is Alpine. So when you log into that machine, you'll look like it's Alpine Linux. And then I'm telling it, use the package manager APK to install Python and pip. Pip is the package manager for Python. And then we're gonna upgrade pip to make sure it's the latest version. And so you literally, if you were at your machine, you would be like apk add dash up dash update pypip. And then what we're saying is take the requirements.txt and copy the requirements.txt from the directory in which the Docker file is running into the container at this location, right? User source app. Then pip install those requirements. So take that requirements file in the container. So all these commands are running in a container that will ultimately become our engine. Install my requirements, copy over my source code, my index.html. This is a Flask-based web app in Python that runs on port. What port does it run on? 5,000, because it's there on line 19. Expose 5,000 tells the container that it has to open up port 5,000 for communication. And then it says when the container starts, run Python and pass it this source code, or pass it the application code. In the Windows example, very, very similar, right? And this is, again, if you have mixed workloads and you're working in both environments, they are very, very similar. So you don't have to kind of retrain your brain on how this stuff works. In this case, we're saying, hey, let's use Microsoft's Windows Server core image. And from that, I'm setting three environment variables in the container. I'm setting the version for the Node package manager, the Node.js version at 6.5. I am telling it the logging level, and I'm giving it a SHA key to be able to do the validation on the download to make sure I got what I thought I got. Then I've got some PowerShell, right? And we're saying run this PowerShell command, and we've got a bunch of stuff in there, but essentially what it's doing is it's downloading a node, it's examining the key to make sure that it's what we thought it is, it's going to then extract it, it's going to rename a subdirectory, it's going to create a subdirectory, it's going to set an environmental path variable, and then it's going to remove the zip archive, right? And then when it starts, it'll run node. What I've just created here is a new base image for node. Now I have a Docker container for Windows that is for Node. If you were a developer, you would take this image, you would add your code, and create a new image that would be your application, right? So you can see the two examples are pretty similar. So putting it all together, build, ship, run. You're a developer. You're going to come up there and you're going to sit down at your workstation, your Windows laptop, your MacBook, your Linux workstation, depending on what you're developing in, and you are going to pull down a base image, right? And in our example here, you're going to pull down the node image. You're going to add your code to it, and you're going to work on your application the way you work on it. We've got great integration with Visual Studio, right? With the Visual Studio, it's Visual Studio Tools, Docker Tools, what is it? Something like that.
Yeah, it's Microsoft. It's going to be like Visual Studio Tools for Docker and the cloud developers.
2017.
Yeah.
XP.
Yeah, RC2. Beta.
Beta 2, RC1. So you're going to pull down, you're going to work in whatever your favorite IDE is. If it's Visual Studio or Eclipse or VI, I don't care. It doesn't matter. Visual Studio Code. Yeah, Visual Studio Code, yeah, sorry. I'm not a developer. So you do your code, and then you create the image, and you push it back up to the registry. So the registry has a two-way relationship, right? It's where the developers will get their base images to start with, and it'll be where you put your finished code. At that point right there, when it goes back up, it's been digitally signed, so you know that it came from who you think it came from and you can deploy it. That's where we go from developers to operations. The operations team will now take that code and they will put it into production. They'll put it in the data center, they'll put it in the cloud. We have tools to manage that. We have a tool called Docker Data Center, which I'll talk a little bit later, that's sort of like if you think about System Center or Microsoft Virtual Machine Manager or any of those tools, that's what we are. We're like vCenter for containers, and Docker Data Center. And we can manage it that way. We can deploy it out into a cluster, high availability, everything we need to do. So that's what the build, ship, run workflow is. And remember, nothing changed. Like, it's the same artifact through all that. So, demo time. Oh boy, here we go. What could possibly go wrong? Anybody here been to DockerCon? So at DockerCon, they do this thing where they have a sacrifice to the demo gods.
Yeah.
And like in Spain, you had to come up and eat grapes. And in Seattle, you had to take a shot of espresso. I don't have grapes or espresso, so I think we're in trouble. So let me come over here in Visual Studio Code, and we're going to start over here and look at my Docker file. We've already looked at it. I'm working on that same Docker file that we talked about before. I'm going to write a Flask app. And so you've already seen this Docker file. So that's the one we're using. Now, if I come over here, I'm using my Windows laptop here, and I say Docker images. I have got my application image already down. So there it is, Mike G. Coleman, CatWeb, right? So if I say docker run dash d dash p, you saw this. I'm very stoked. I actually have Mike G. Coleman everywhere. Twitter, Facebook, GitHub, Docker Hub. I never have to worry about what my username is. Don't hack me. Yeah, I use the same password everywhere. It's password 123. So we hit enter here, and we're fired off the container, right? So see how fast that came up? That's how fast we instantiate my application. So if I come over here to Internet Explorer, and I go over to localhost 5000, you can see my app. What? I'm going to be getting some Snapchat money pretty soon. So it shows a random cat GIF every time you refresh it. So what if I wanted to update my application? Well, I'm not a developer, but I can code a little bit of HTML. So if I come over here to the index.html file, and oh, by the way, I've never actually done this, so let's see if it works. So we're going to make it Taylor's totally random cat GIF of the day, and we're going to save this off. And then we're going to come back over here. And remember, just real quick, I'm going to back up here real fast. Remember in the Docker file, we copy that index.html into the container right here. So that's the code change I made. So if you're a developer, that would be a real change, right? You'd be doing your development and working on it, and I'm kind of just monkeying around. So I'm going to come back over here, and I'm going to do a couple of things. I'm going to do a Docker, don't ever do this, mysf 2e145. If I was being disciplined, I would have stopped the container, then removed it. Here I just told it remove it and force it. So I'm going to do a Docker build, dash T, Mike G. Coleman, CatWeb, and I'm going to version it with an intuitive version name of Taylor, and I'm going to hit pound. And so that's basically telling Docker, hey, build me a new version of the CatWeb application based on the current Docker file. And it's pretty fast, because the only thing it really needed to do was copy over that new index.html file, right? So that's why it built so quickly. So if I clear the screen here, and I go back to my history, and I run this again, but I give it the right version, I'm running Taylor, and I hit enter, wait for my container to start up, boom. So let's come back over here, and we do a refresh. So I just made a code change. Okay, cool. So that's the build, right? Now we're gonna do the ship. So we come over here, and we just say Docker push, Mike G. Coleman, CatWeb, Taylor. And we're pushing that version of my code up to, oh no, this is going to be problematic.
Do you remember your password?
Yeah, I do, actually. I can't remember my user ID, though. All right, let's try this again. I didn't authenticate to my repo before I started the demo. So Docker Hub said, hey, I don't know who you are. You can't just push to that repo. So please log in. So do Docker login, Docker push, and get that up there. So this will take a couple of seconds, pushing it up there to finish up. So it's now. So we talked about layers, and we'll talk about them more in the next session. But you can see all of those hashes. Each one of those hashes represents a layer in my Docker image. A layer is created every time you execute a command in a Docker file. So while this is going back, let me come back over here. And this is a good example. This PowerShell, that's why it's so amalgamated. That's why it's not one command on every line. Because one command on every line would be a new layer in your Docker file or in your Docker image. So every command here like sets a layer. Layers add complexity to the image, and they can slow it down because you have to traverse the file system to work through the layers. And we'll talk about that in the next session a little bit. But that's why you'll see these Docker files with these like incredibly long concatenated commands.
Yeah, and we've got some a really good doc for Windows that talks about when you're building a Windows image using Docker files, how do you optimize that Docker file in order to keep the image size as small as possible while still maintaining the flexibility.
And one of the cool things is, if you take a base image, let's say you've got an image and your base image, your node image is 100 megabytes. That image is read-only and shared across all instances on your registry, as well as when it's running on your server. So you could be running that 100 megabytes 1,000 times, but it only exists on the system one time. So optimizes your storage. So, okay, let's go here. So now we're gonna do the ship part. So I am up here on my Azure VM. So this is actually a Linux VM in Azure because we don't have the production bits for Server 2016, so I just went with Linux. So if I just come up here and I just say docker run dash d dash p, you guys should know this by now, 5000, what's my username? I can't remember. And Catweb Taylor. And if I hit enter, can't find it locally, so it says, well, I don't know where that image is. Now, alternately, if I didn't, I could do a Docker pull first. I could say Docker pull that image. Or I can just say Docker run. If the image is not there, it'll pull it for me. So it went out to the registry, Docker Hub, pulled the image and instantiated it. So now if I come over here, and I go to this is gonna be fun. Let's see if it works. I have just taken a workload that I wrote on my Windows desktop and moved it into a Linux VM on Azure in about 30 seconds without touching anything. I didn't have to do anything. So, and it wasn't spoken, I swear to you, it was that image. I didn't just pick Taylor, I picked Taylor literally on the spot. There's somebody out there going, nah, man, he had that pre-staged, that's not real. I know you're out there. Anyway, there's all my Docker images. You can see the latest version here. Taylor was built 34 minutes ago. All right, that's the demo. All right, here it is, I'll show it to you anyway. Even though the demo worked, I'll show you the other thing. This, ladies and gentlemen, is me and Bill Gates in an earthquake.
Well, we have seen some amazing video today as the earthquake hit.
That's me. Look at that hair. That's Bill Gates. That's an earthquake. So we're on stage, just like Taylor and I are right now. Bill's over here, I'm over there. I'm like, I'm gonna plug the camera into Windows XP and it's gonna be the coolest thing you've ever seen. And then like this earthquake happens. And I'm standing there and I'm looking at one of the world's richest men and he's just standing there like nothing is happening because he's calm, cool, and collected. And I'm being calm, cool, and collected till a light canister crashes onto the stage, at which point I literally run off the stage. Bill's standing there and he goes, and he just walks off. So I get back to my office And like everybody's like, what's up, Running Man? You just left the CEO on stage. Like, well, I wasn't gonna grab him. He has his own like handlers. Anyway. So next to Chris Capicella blue screening Windows 95, this might be the other biggest demo crash ever in Microsoft history. All right, back to the slides. I don't have anything nearly that fun to show you after this. It's all downhill from here. So container architecture. So we talked about this a little bit. This is a picture that shows it kind of like literally one of the world's worst graphics ever. But basically what you've got is every container, as we said before, it's sort of representing what we saw in that Docker file, is a layer. So if you look at the blue one, that literally was like from Debian, apk add Emacs, apk add Apache, and run the container. So I've created a Debian container with Emacs and Apache on it. What differentiates an image from a container is a read-write layer on top of it. Let me tell you the dirty little secret about containers. They don't save anything. When you power down or kill that container, that rewritable container layer goes away. We'll talk about how you solve that problem in the future. But they are they basically are totally non-persistent. So the Docker file system, and Taylor can chime in a little bit on how Windows implemented this. I can talk about it from the Linux side. But we use different file system drivers depending on your operating system. So we use AUFS on Ubuntu, and we use Device Mapper on Red Hat. And those basically take together those layers, and they layer them on top of each other. And so we have this sort of bottoms-up approach. So if you start with a base image that has, or a base layer that has a var lib directory, and you modify that in a subsequent step by, say, adding, like making var lib logs, that will exist in a higher level layer. And the topmost layer wins, right? The most recent layer wins. So each branch in that tree, each layer, is a Docker image. So if you're using AUFS on Linux, you can literally go into the varlib Docker directory, and you can start looking at all of these layers. They're just subdirectories. In Device Mapper, they're blocks, so it's a little bit, you can't really do that. But it allows you to basically take an image and build it from the ground up with exactly what you need. It doesn't have to have any more than you want in it. And then, like I said, when we start the container, we add a writable layer. So you want to add anything about Windows containers?
Yeah, well, Windows is actually done pretty similarly. We use a file system filter driver, which you can ignore the way that it's implemented for the sake of this. But it's the same kind of thing. There's a layer, and we just layer things on top of it. And then we use basically junction points or pointers to construct what looks like a real file system out of that. So if you go into C : program data, Docker, Windows filter, layers, graph, some directory in there, there's like a whole bunch of folders that are the hashes, the SHA hashes of the images, or of the layers, and inside of that is the files.
Yeah. So again, basically the exact same sort of architecture. This is how we can share those. That's why you only have one Windows Server Core layer for everything, because it's shared that way and it gets layered in. So copy on write is what actually creates the container. Copy on write is that idea of creating that rewritable layer. As soon as a change is written to the file system, we're going to add that layer, and we're going to bubble that change up into that layer. It's also why we can start containers so fast. I say sub-second up on here. For a small Linux container, 3/8 of a second. And new containers literally take about a mega space, because there's no difference. If you had a bunch of containers that were all just like sort of a read-only website, like they just read content, there was no writes, they would never grow in size, and they would 1,000 of them would take, you know, just a little bit more than one of them. Like I said, it looks like it's a copy, but it looks like it's unique to every container, but really we're just linking back. So those junction points or the symbolic links or whatever it is. And we talk about, you know, if someone writes a change to the file system, not really someone, if a process writes a change to the file system, a copy of that file or directory is copied up the stack. Remember, the very top layer wins. So that's how containers are put together. They're just an amalgamation of blocks or subdirectories that we glue together to look like a true file system inside the container. But that's where a lot of the efficiencies come in both performance and storage utilization. So I told you that data doesn't persist in a container. So people say, well, what do I do for databases? People say, well, you can't run a database in a container. We have a customer, Swisscom, who ran and consolidated 400 database instances, running each running in their own VM, into 20 VMs with 20 containers in each VM. So they went from 400 VMs to 20 VMs, and they run all their all those databases, 400 instances of Mongo in a container. How do you do that? You do that with volumes. Volumes basically exist outside of that union file system. Union file system is a generic term for any file system that's sort of amalgamated together. So outside of that union file system, on the Docker host, is a directory. And you say when you start it, you use a -v, -volume command, and you say, for this directory in the container, database slash data, put that out here to host slash database slash data. And that allows those writes to exit the container and remain on persistent storage. If the container goes away, you start up another container, you can attach it back to that same data, right? And so that, it gets a little more complex than that, but that's the basic gist. You can actually do some other very cool things with that. I didn't do it in this demo, but you saw me go out and edit and code and rebuild, edit my index.html and reload it and do another build. In reality, you can hot mount your local file system into your container as a developer, and your changes are immediately reflected. Right? You don't have to rebuild it. You basically can be working, make a change, go into the look at the container output, and see the change reflected immediately. I didn't do that here because the honestly, because like the directory path I was using was too complicated to type. So I just like cheated. So you can create it in a Docker file, you can create it on the CLI, right? And like I said, maps an existing directory on the host, and you can use that to either share data between containers or persist data. The sharing example, a good example of a sharing is you have an application that writes log data. And it writes that log data out to a volume, and you have another container that consumes that log data, right? So multiple containers can hit the same thing. Your application needs to be smart about this. If you have two applications, two containers sharing a volume, and you're not like doing something to synchronize the writes, like we're not gonna protect you.
In the case of Windows, if container one opens that file for write access, and container two comes along and it's like, hey, I wanna write to that, nope, we will, invalid handle, nope, you know, you're not going to get to write to that file, right? Because that's just the Windows semantics. It's just like if I open a file on a network share and then I go home for the day and then I get called like an hour later, like, dude, you kind of locked the whatever thing we're working on. And it's like, yeah, okay, back to the office I go to log in and close that file, right? So you do have to be a little careful with it. The other point I'll make about this, though, is there's an artifact of doing this that's really, really, really powerful. You now know exactly what data is what is the important for the application, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the files that got mapped out, the directory that got mapped out, that's what you have to back up. You don't have to back up the whole container image anymore. You now know that those are the only files that matter in the world because you went through the process of separating the state.
Yeah, and that's super powerful. The other part of this is, someone will say to me, well, is it NFS? Is it Ceph? Is it, guess what? I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's whatever the host sees. Yeah.
In the case of Windows, we care a little bit for now. We can't mount a volume on an SMB share.
Okay, fair enough.
That's a V1 limitation that we have. So it has to be local to the host. Local meaning it can be an iSCSI volume. It can be a SAN volume. It can be a local disk. It could be a USB key. It could be a floppy disk if you happen to have one. I apologize, but like as long as it's local to that machine, we can mount it.
Yeah. And so, again, you know, flexibility. So all right. So we told you, and I kind of given you some of the why, but let's like recap that. Customers come to us. Here's the requisite marketing slide. Customers come to us and they say, you know, we want to do a myriad of different things that are very strategic. And we did a survey, and four of the most important things are application modernization, DevOps transformation, and cloud strategy. Docker makes all of those things easier, right? Containers make all of those things easier. And I think I don't have to really go into it because we've talked about I will talk about one. Actually, I'll save it because I have a slide on it. So customers who adopt Docker containers are releasing software 13 times faster. We've had customers who would ship once a year. They containerize their applications. They ship multiple times a day, hundreds of times a month, thousands of times a year. It takes 65% less time to onboard a developer. You can walk in, I can hand you a laptop with Docker for Mac on it. I can say, there's the Docker file. You can immediately run that application. There's no download this library, download this, download. You just immediately can go to work. We talked about the portability. 40% of our customers are moving workloads between private and public clouds. And control, right? You have a higher degree of control, and that drives down costs. It just makes it easier to do your job. So one of the things, so when I came to Docker, like I said, about 15 months ago, it was just like you did not say containers and followed up with microservices, right? It was like containers were only for microservices. And that's actually not true. We have a large percentage of our customers that are doing legacy applications, lift and shift. They want that portability, right? They want to be able to easily move an application between environments. So they say, I'm going to put it in a container. Even if I'm going to run it in a VM, I'm still going to run it in a container because I want to be able to move it. Some customers will take those applications and they will move them into the data center into a container as a monolith, and they will start breaking it apart. And they will say, all right, well, I'm going to take out the auth system and put the auth system in a container of its own. And they will transform a legacy application into microservices, right? And some people basically just say, all right, I'm deploying microservices. And they start with containers. They start with microservices from there. So one of the things that we have up on the PowerShell gallery is a tool called Image to Docker. And what Image to Docker does is it takes a virtualized workload and it inspects it and looks at it and sort of figures out what it is and helps you move that existing workload into a container. So this is a lift and shift enabler. It allows you to take a Hyper-V VM and get that workload containerized more rapidly. So you can go up in the PowerShell gallery and find it. I'm kind of going pretty quick because I definitely want to leave time for questions. Docker Data Center, come by our booth. We're on aisle 700. So if you go to the far right end of the Microsoft booth and sort of just turn the corner, we're right there under the 700 sign. We can show you Docker Data Center. But it is a web-based application for managing Docker containers. It's comprised of something called Universal Control Plane, which is actually the management front end, Docker Trusted Registry, which is that registry, as well as commercially supported Docker Engine. Right? So we are open source, but if you want support for your Docker Engine, Microsoft offers that on Windows Server 2016. We help them with the level 3 support. We offer it with Linux. You can also get support from partners like IBM and HPE. Right, and so a whole bunch of things here that you can do, but there's a security networking, creating volumes, listing it out, checking out utilization. Today, this is Linux only. By the end of the year, we're gonna have a beta for Windows environments, right? So we will have the ability to manage Windows clusters as well. So the use case, I was actually gonna talk about a little bit of a DevOps case, and basically, we talked about the reduction in complexity and time. If you have a VM and you have to scale test your web front end and you want to scale test it to 1,000 instances and it takes you 7 minutes to boot up that VM, and let's say you can boot 10 VMs simultaneously, so you need to do 100 separate boot instances, that's 700 minutes, that's roughly 12 hours just to instantiate the environment to scale test. In Docker, with some containers, you could do that in a matter of minutes, right? They start up in less than a second. Let's say they start up in 7 seconds, or they said 7 seconds to start up. It's still a 60-time reduction in the amount of time it takes to stand up that environment for QA. And oh, by the way, forget about the fact that you no longer have to have build servers in your QA pipeline that are specific to a Java or a .NET or whatever, they're just Docker hosts. And those jobs can be run on any server in your farm now. And those machines don't have to have complex configurations on them. So we're going to be faster. So you can literally have a workflow where a developer pushes to GitHub. And when that push happens, it reaches out to something like Jenkins, right, for instance. And Jenkins, which is a automated QA test tool, Jenkins will go out to Docker Hub, Docker your registry hub or whatever. It'll pull down the image. It'll execute your tests for you on a Jenkins worker machine that's configured with the Docker engine. And then it can push that out to production for you. Fully automated, super simple, one artifact, much quicker with much less overhead to do it. So how do I get started? I wanted to leave 10 minutes for questions, so I'm going to do this section in about 30 seconds. Probably not. Super easy though, right? Like if you want to do it on Linux, create a Linux VM or get a Linux laptop and you literally run curl-ssl https getdocker.com and pipe that to shell. If you want to do experimental builds, do experimental.docker.com. If you want to do beta builds, do test.docker.com. If you don't want to pipe to shell, or if you want to see exactly what's happening, check the docs out. It will tell you exactly how to install it. It's about 5 commands. Literally takes about 3 minutes to install Docker on Linux. Docker for Mac and Docker for Windows, the easiest way to get started on Docker, bar none.
Yep.
It is the easiest way. And to me, the better of the two, and I use a MacBook every day, is Docker for Windows. If you are a Windows user, that is awesome. You basically download it, you install it, and what we do is we create a VM or VMs on your machine that run Linux or Windows Pro or Windows, and you basically then use the local command interface, the local shell, to execute against that VM running on that machine. So in Windows 10 Pro Enterprise and Education, I guess it's Education, you can run Hyper-V on that.
You need the Anniversary Edition for Windows 10, because we actually use Hyper-V containers on Windows 10, so we actually make that little VM completely transparent for the Windows containers. So,
and the reason I said that Docker for Windows is cooler is that in Docker for Windows you can actually switch between Linux and Windows, so you can develop for both platforms on a Windows machine, and you literally just go into the bottom right hand corner, you say switch to Windows, switch to Linux, and you can develop on both. On the on the MacBook side, you're only doing Linux development. The cool thing, as we mentioned before, full API and CLI compatibility across the entire spectrum. And the integration with Hyper-V, the integration with Xhive on the MacBook makes this super fast, super efficient. You can share the local file system. Literally, go download it. If you download this today, you can download it in 2 minutes and be up and running. You can run your first container in less than 5 minutes.
So before the session's out.
Yeah, we gotta go. Yeah, it's gonna be quick. Azure private beta, we have something called Docker for Azure, which allows you to stand up Docker clusters easily on Azure. You can scale them up and down, and we integrate it with the underlying platform, so it takes care of things like load balancers and whatnot. And then Windows Server 2016, it's one bullet because it's that simple, right? It's install-docker.
Yeah, so right now there's still a few additional steps. Next week we're gonna turn that on to, it'll literally just be install-docker. And it'll take care of all of the setup for you.
I don't know.
Reboot and you're up and running.
Yeah, I don't know how it could be any easier. So there you go. So what do you do? What do you do? Walk, jog, run. Go and get a Docker environment today. Go install Docker for Windows, Docker for Mac, whatever it is. And then type this. Well, if it's on Linux, you type docker run hello-world. On Windows, type docker run Microsoft/Windows Server Core dir /c://
We actually have a Hello World example.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah, we built our little Hello World as well. So I think it's
Microsoft Hello
Microsoft/Hello World
Yeah,
and it's in the documentation.
Yeah, and you have one in your first container, right? Nginx, Hello World. You can even run my cat web program if you're on Linux. then jog. Pick a well-documented use case. So for me, I used WordPress and Jenkins. There are 1,000 blogs. And I just saw a good one on deploying your first IIS app web application with Docker containers, right? So go find a blog and just do what that person did, step by step. Learn how they put their Docker file together. Maybe they use Docker Compose, which is a way to orchestrate multi-container applications. Play with that, get real familiar and really understand what they did, then go do your own. Pick some application that you think is cool or not, build your own Docker file, and try compose, and maybe even swarm mode, which is clustering of Docker machines. You can do that, and you will know more, literally, than probably 99% of the people on the planet about Docker. And you'll be ahead of the game. I wrote a blog post on this with a little more information up at docker.com if you want to read it, but I just basically gave it to you. So thank you so much. Really, the turnout here is overwhelming. The support of the Docker project from our community, if those of you who've been part of that, thank you so much for that. I'll stick around and do questions. We have microphones in these aisles. So if you have a question, come to a microphone in the aisle, and Taylor and I will answer them.
And the one thing I will also note, I forgot to say this at the beginning, the slides are already available. If you go to my Twitter, TaylorB_Microsoft, I've tweeted out the location of the slides. I now post all of my slides before the session, so go forth and get
them. I will find his tweet and retweet it. So do we have a question on this one back here?
Yeah. So can you give a little information about what's contained in a Hyper-V container image?
What's contained in a Hyper-V container image? So it's actually the same. So all container images are portable between each other, Windows Server containers and Hyper-V containers. It's the same image. And ultimately, all we're doing is we're booting up this little shell VM. We call it a utility VM. And then we're running a container inside of it. So it's just the same image. Yeah.
Okay. Over, we'll go to the right side, or the left side for you guys, the right side for us.
Yeah. Thanks. So my question is, I mean, obviously you have Docker for Windows Server 2016, you have it for Nano Server, you've got an instance for Windows Desktop Enterprise. What is the plan for Windows 10 IoT Core and Docker containers?
I was wondering if anybody was going to ask that. We are talking to the IoT team pretty regularly right now. I will say there's no formal plans right now. Like, I can safely say that. There is a lot of interest, though, and we're trying to figure out what is the right use cases and how do we align those. And frankly, it's really a matter of time. So it'll happen. I believe that.
Thank you.
This side.
You mentioned that if I want to run a database on Docker, I would rather have a folder somewhere else and the hosting machine to write the data in there. Would there be any performance issue doing that?
So the thing, and I didn't really talk about performance, but remember that Docker is not in a VM. Docker is a process on the machine, so you get near native performance. And the reality is, if you're running a database, you're probably gonna shuffle it off to some other storage subsystem anyway, so I don't think you're gonna see any substantial performance degradation on that at all. Go to the HP study that I mentioned before, and they actually use HammerDB to simulate a database access, and you can actually see the difference between running it in a container and running it natively. And that'll also give you an idea of because they'll tell you what storage subsystem they used, so you can get some real data. But the reality is that because we're not in a VM, we're running natively, performance hits are very minimal.
Yeah, and we're gonna be publishing some of our perf testing and how we did it, and some of the results around it as well over probably the next couple months. Because it's perf testing, we like to validate and revalidate and re-revalidate before we put numbers out. So, you know, keep an eye out for that. I'll be tweeting that out as that stuff starts to come available as well.
Okay.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. So can I say that this is a solution for get rid of my legacy operating systems like 2003 and very soon 2008, and I can pick up those applications and run on Windows 2016 in a container, like legacy MSI applications as an example?
So all containers are, for Windows anyway, are based on Server 2016. But most applications that were 2008, even 2003, can run in a server core environment. And I say most because not all of them can. If you've got a driver, drivers and containers do not get along. Why? Because we have a shared kernel, right? Like, that's just a big no-no. But if your application's a .NET app, if it's a VB app, if it's, you know, all of those things that you know, generally just kind of work, they pretty well work on in containers.
Okay, so as far as there is no dependency on the OS kernel for that application, like a legacy kernel,
yeah.
And if they have like a dependency on legacy .NET framework as an example, I can just take it on to the 2016?
Right, like if it had a dependency on .NET 2.0, that doesn't work on Server 2016. Yeah, sorry. But if it's 3.5, 4.6 compatible, You can move that across. If you can install it on Server 2016, you can move it across.
So even though I'm on container, and if my application has dependency on .NET 2.0 as an example, I cannot run it even on the container on 2016?
Yeah, because I have to double check. I don't think .NET 2.0 will install on Server 2016.
I'm running in a container, actually. Everything you do in the container file, right?
Right, but so remember what we said, though, right? The container is based on the kernel of the operating system. So unlike a virtualized environment, you're essentially running on that version of the machine. And so in the Windows sense, it's a Server 2016 environment.
It would be the same thing in Linux. If you had a dependency on a pre-modern kernel, I guess.
If it wasn't 3.1 or later.
Then your app wouldn't work in a container either, because you're depending on something that we can't provide you.
Yeah, if you had a Linux application that had a call into the kernel that was deprecated out in later than 3.1, you wouldn't be able to run that application as well, right? The kernels have to be compatible. The application has to be compatible with the environment. So if you can run an application in that environment, then you can move it into a container. But if it doesn't run in that environment, the containers are not magic in that regard.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So when developing web applications, you usually develop against a database. So locally, using Docker Compose, you can set up an environment where you have your application server running in one container and the database running in another container. How do you configure your application, your container, when you want to deploy up to a service like Azure that is going to be running against a database service rather than just a database in a container?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, so containers have networking built into them, so you would do it just like a normal application, right? Essentially, you would just make the call, and the container would take that just like it would. So containers can talk to VMs, containers can talk to physical services, containers can talk to web services, containers can talk to whatever, because we have the networking in there. So fundamentally, the answer to your question is you don't really do anything differently, right? You just say, open database at www.database.com or at, whatever the network path to get to that is or whatever the service call to that is.
Right, but the configuration would be different from one environment to the next. So how do you build that?
Yeah, so that is a thing with containers that can cause problems. If you have static configs per container and you don't want to build an image for every one of those, then you have a problem that you need to solve.
And there's a couple ways to facilitate that. One, you can set environment variables, and you can override those at startup time. So you could say an environment variable is the connection string to the SQL database. And so when I'm running locally, it might be local host whatever, right? And then when I go to production, I say like production host whatever as that environment variable, right? So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it would be using a volume and having a file that has the database in it. So I might actually map in the web.config file at runtime into the container from the host. That's another way to do it, right?
Yeah, and that's, you see that a lot with web configs, right? You like an Apache config or whatever, you just be like, oh, get the config file exists here, map it in here, right. And so that you can have that config file that changes as you boot up.
The question I had is, a lot of times we have Docker containers and all, may run as root in the Linux and other things. We may not necessarily want to give all those privileges and other things, because one of the questions would be, from a image perspective, how do we ensure that we don't have malicious images that we're potentially pulling from these registries and all too, or something that may not quite be
right? So gentleman's question was like, how do you trust that image? A couple things, right? So you can build your own base images. You can absolutely go out and say, I'm going to start at the, in the Linux world, you can start at the bottom and just build it. The other thing we have in Hub today and coming to Docker Trusted Registry is ability to do, we talked about the image signing. So you've got the provenance that says, I know where this came from because it's digitally signed. I'm using something called Docker Content Trust, and I will not deploy an image or a container that is not based on an image that I trust. The other thing that we have is something called Docker security scanning. And Docker security scanning goes and says, I'm constantly out there looking at the layers. And I'm comparing those layers and what's in them to a number of CVE databases, common vulnerabilities and exploits. And if we see something, we can let you know and be like, hey, that layer has heartbleed or nosebleed or earache or whatever the latest one is. We did a demo of a proof of concept at DockerCon using Docker Data Center, then when you can identify that. And remember, everything's based off those layers. You patch that layer, rebuild those images, and they're patched, and we roll them out. So we're gonna, you know, in the future, we're gonna have this ability with Docker Data Center to be like, boom, patch that layer, find the affected machines, remediate them, let me know how it went. But so through Docker Content Trust and security scanning, that's how we protect you and make sure that that you're running what you think you are running and it came from who you think it came from. And once it is running, how do we make sure that it is in a state that you want it to be in and that you're aware of any vulnerabilities you have?
And we layered one more part on that for Windows. When you pull an image, every image, unless you disable it, we run Defender on it before we actually allow that image to be fully extracted. So you got one more kind of layer of trust on top of it. And then, of course, all the binary scanning and file hashes and signatures apply to it as well. So I know we're running a little over time, so if we get kicked off stage, don't worry, we'll be around to answer questions.
We'll hang out. And then, yeah, we both have booths, of course. We both have booths that you can come talk to us too. I mean, I'm going to my booth after this, but.
So it's a little bit of a two-parter around the.
I'm sorry, it's one question per person.
Well.
All right, now we're being kicked out. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Come by the Docker booth. I got t-shirts I got to give away before the end of the day today, so come by and get one.